Divided Kingdom. We're coming to you on June 20th, 2019. We have some very serious concerns. The Washington Times for June 17th had this kind of a headline, Foreign Policy by Lauren Meyer. Military hit on the table as response to attack on oil tankers. Speaking on Fox News Sunday, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said it was unmistakable that Iran conducted the attacks with the clear intent to deny transit through the strait, through which about a fifth of the world's oil is transported daily. And we have to mention that these were so-called military strikes that were in response to attacks on two oil tankers near the Strait of Hormuz last week. And, of course, our administration claims this was carried out by Iranian troops. The Pentagon, going back to the article, late Thursday, released photographs and a grainy black and white video purportedly showing Islamic Revolutionary Guard troops removing an unexploded mine from the side of an oil tanker targeted in the Gulf of Oman earlier that day. U.S. Central Command said American forces in the region witnessed and recorded an Iranian boat approach the oil tanker Kokuka Courageous and remove an unexploded limpet mine from the side of the vessel. The video footage released by the Defense Department appears to show a small device being removed from the ship. Not everyone, however, is convinced by the U.S. take on how the situation unfolded. Germany's foreign minister has requested additional evidence before pointing blame on Tehran and said the video released by the Pentagon is not enough to draw conclusions. And, of course, the article also says that U.S. officials said that limpet mines also were used in a May attack on four oil tankers, which the Trump administration also has blamed on Iran. There also have been disputing claims about the attack. The Japanese owner of one of the tankers has told of his crew's account of the incident and said the ship was hit by a flying object, not a mine. Saudi Arabia, the world's largest exporter of crude oil, and Britain have joined the U.S. in pointing fingers at Iran. We really do have to bring this to serious prayer time. We know that the deep state, the New World Order, has wanted the Middle East to be completely in flames for decades. Dr. Stan Monteith gave us an important program one time about the coming war in Iran, and he discussed how the large automakers in America and other large industries were really linked with Hitler in many ways. In many ways, the common person does not understand war, but General Smedley Butler did. He said war is a racket. That's what it is. And we hope that we will not be taking our people, killing our young men again. President Trump promised this, that we would not be doing this, and we still hope and pray he will shortly bring home our young men and young women from Afghanistan. And, of course, we also have to keep our eyes open for the other headline on Monday, June 17th, in the Washington Times. Chinese military tries to provoke U.S. forces at base in Djibouti. And Rear Admiral Heidi Berg, the Director of Intelligence at the U.S. Africa Command, told a small group of African-based journalists in a telephone media roundtable that China had carried out irresponsible actions, such as trying to constrain international airspace by barring aircraft from flying over the Chinese military base, flashing ground-based lasers into the eyes of American pilots, and deploying drones designed to interfere with U.S. flight operations. The U.S. Admiral said that Chinese personnel even attempted intrusion activity, a military term for covert entry with attempts to gain access to the American camp. Some of these things are undoubtedly real. Some of them may be set up to take us into that dreaded war. We were very, very happy with the speech of President Trump, in which he has told us he will run again for President of the United States for the second term. It was a wonderful speech, and I believe that all of us Christians can see that the heart of the man is love, and he does love American people. He gave us so many results that have been so good. First of all, this is Elizabeth Cuppet Caverly and my co-host Lou Caverly. Lou Caverly, he talked about the TPP, didn't he? And he also
yes.
talked about what were some of the things that you thought really applied to the ordinary person in America, where things had changed and for the betterment.
Well, one of the obvious things is reducing taxes. That affected us, and I think it affected almost all Americans, especially the ordinary person.
Yes, you know that you and I had to borrow money for the last several years because of the drain of our radio work, very stressed out. We did not have to borrow this year in paying our taxes.
That's right. And there are many other things. Jobs, increasing jobs, lowering of unemployment, that certainly affects the average man.
Yes, didn't he say that the unemployment rate for African Americans and I believe for Hispanics, that it was at the lowest all-time record, maybe since 1969 or something like that?
Yes, I think that's a pretty accurate, something like that. We may not have the year exact,
no,
but it's close.
But it was in the 60s, I believe.
Yes, that's right.
And the factory jobs, some of them are coming back. He has kept many of his promises to us. And I think that he's going to help us more on the border. We really must have that done. Representative Andy Harris from Maryland had a newspaper piece recently in which he said there are 700,000 cases backed up for asylum. And perhaps one of the remedies for that situation, this is of illegal aliens, of course, one of the remedies may be to start with the last cases first, because some of these people get in and they think that they can be here forever till their case comes up. So things like that are still going on. We must have our borders closed, and the Washington Times reported a new development. Former acting ICE chief to take over as border czar. President Trump will appoint Thomas D. Homan, a top former Homeland Security official, as his new border czar. Tom Homan's coming back, the president said in a Friday interview on Fox and Friends. He'll be a border czar. He'll be reporting directly to me. He'll be probably working out of the White House. Mr. Homan, 57, is a blunt-talking former acting director of U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. He has lately been a Fox News contributor and commentator supporting Mr. Trump's border security proposals. The president said he intended to make the announcement this week, but I'd rather announce it now. Mr. Homan had been poised to retire from ICE in early 2017 when John F. Kelly, then Mr. Trump's Homeland Security chief, asked him to stay on and become director. He was nominated and served as acting director, but the pick went nowhere on Capitol Hill. This new post would not require Senate confirmation. Quote, the border has become increasingly porous and action is desperately needed. Tom Homan is uniquely qualified to address these problems, said Dale L. Wilcox, executive director of the Immigration Reform Law Institute. And we heard excellent coverage on InfoWars about a week ago. Then it came on to Fox News with Laura Ingraham's program that a number of people were coming from the Congo, and they were coming into Texas. They were being brought into Texas from the Congo, where right now the second worst Ebola outbreak is occurring. We heard that the Mike Adams of Natural News also was on InfoWars, and of course he has a great medical background. And he informed the audience of InfoWars that the Ebola can lie latent in a man's sperm for 12 months. Now, Lou, we picture these people who come in and look pretty well. What could spread?
Well, Ebola could spread very simply. and it would be a while before you would even realize there was anything going on. The medical establishment would be, caught by surprise, I believe.
Not good. Not good. I believe that you have some more things there. In a moment, you will be giving those. I think about the situation there with the border and the situation that's going on. But before we get to that, I think that next we will have something out of Time Magazine for June 17th, 2019. And this was under news ticker, U.S. sets up for tech antitrust probes. The Justice Department and the Federal Trade Commission are planning to split oversight of tech companies as Congress increases its scrutiny of Silicon Valley. Potential antitrust investigations of Apple and Google would go to the DOJ, with the FTC taking Facebook and Amazon. Let's delve a little deeper into this story, Lou.
Yes, Elizabeth.
And then you will be getting into something from Orwell.
Yes. Now, let me make sure I have what we're talking about here.
I believe that you do have the Orwellian article. That's what we want next.
Yes. Here we go. Yes, Elizabeth, Time writer Shoshana Zuboff, June 17th, has an article, The Threat of Big Other. Not Big Brother, Big Other. She begins it with this impassioned biographical sketch. George Orwell delayed crucial medical care to finish 1984, the book still synonymous with our worst fears of a totalitarian future, published 70 years ago this month. Half a year later, he was dead. Because he believed everything was at stake, he forfeited everything. But today we are haunted by a question. Did George Orwell die in vain? Eric Blair, and this is Lou interjecting, Eric Blair, the real name for George Orwell, was high in British intelligence when he saw the handwriting on the wall. Now, continuing with Zuboff, she says, Orwell sought to awaken British and U.S. societies to the totalitarian dangers that threaten democracy, even after his Nazi defeat. In letters before and after his novel's completion, Orwell urged, quote, constant criticism, unquote, warning that any immunity to totalitarianism must not be taken for granted. Totalitarianism, and this is in quotes, if not fought against, could triumph anywhere, unquote. Since 1984's debut, we've assumed, with Orwell, that the dangers of mass surveillance and social control could originate only in the state. We were wrong. This era has left us unprotected from an equally pernicious but profoundly different threat to freedom and democracy. For 19 years, private companies practicing an unprecedented economic logic that I call surveillance capitalism have hijacked the Internet and its digital technologies. Invented at Google beginning in the year 2000, this new economics covertly exclaims private human experience as free raw material for translation into behavioral data. Some data are used to improve services, but the rest are turned into computational products that predict your behavior. These predictions are traded in a new futures market where surveillance capitalists sell certainty to businesses determined to know what we will do next. This logic was first applied to finding which ads online will attract our interest. But similar practices now reside in nearly every sector: insurance, retail, health, education, finance, and more, where personal experience is secretly captured and computed. In the competition for certainty, surveillance capitalists learned the most predictive data comes not just from monitoring, but also from directing behavior. For example, by 2013, Facebook had learned how to engineer subliminal cues on its pages to shape users' real-world actions and feelings. Later, these methods were combined with real-time emotional analyses, allowing marketers to cue behavior at the moment of maximum vulnerability. These inventions were celebrated for being both effective and undetectable. Cambridge Analytica later demonstrated that the same methods could be employed to shape political rather than commercial behavior. Democracy slept while surveillance capitalism flourished. As a result, surveillance capitalists now wield a uniquely 21st century quality of power, as unprecedented as totalitarianism was nearly a century ago. I call it instrumentarian power, because it works its will through the ubiquitous architecture of digital instrumentation. Rather than an intimate big brother that uses murder and terror to possess each soul from the inside out, these digital networks are a big other, impersonal systems trained to monitor and shape our actions remotely, unimpeded by law. Instrumentarian power does not want to break us. It simply wants to automate us. It does not care what we think, feel, or do, as long as we think, feel, and do things in ways that are accessible to Big Other's billions of sensate, computational, actuating eyes and ears. Big Other knows everything, while its operations remain hidden, eliminating our right to resist. Because this power does not claim our bodies through violence and fear, we undervalue its effects and lower our guard. Instrumentarian power exiles us from our own behavior. It delivers our futures to surveillance capitalism's interests, and it undermines human autonomy and self-determination, without which democracy cannot survive. Surveillance capitalists falsely claim their methods are inevitable consequences of digital technologies. But Orwell despised, quote, the instinct to bow down before the conqueror of the moment, unquote. Courage, he insisted, demands that we assert our morals even against forces that appear invincible. 7 decades later, we can honor Orwell's death by refusing to cede the digital future. Like Orwell, think critically and criticize. Do not take freedom for granted. Fight for the one idea in the long human story that asserts the people's right to rule themselves. Orwell reckoned it was worth dying for. And this is Lou interjecting. Winston's job, and Winston was the hero of the book, 1984, Winston's job was to rewrite history, taking old newspaper stories and destroying them, and then writing replacements. The old stories went into the memory hole. Time writer Shoshana Zuboff is only wrong when she says instrumentarian power does not want to break us. It simply wants to automate us. It does not care what we think, feel, or do. No, there are concentrated attempts at evil done by actual human beings who would bring in the full force of socialism's tyranny, all the anti-human, anti-conservative gulags. This is not just a fantasy. The deliberate, purposeful targeting and marginalizing through fraud, libel, and dirty tricks is happening, isn't it, Elizabeth?
Yes, it certainly is. And an update on June the 18th was the continued onslaught on InfoWars and Alex Jones. Apparently, the New York Times picked up from the Connecticut Post. It originated in the Connecticut Post, even though I believe the Hartford Courant had exposed it as being a fraudulent. We now had a very dangerous kind of fraud to set someone up. And esteemed lawyer Robert Barnes, who represented the Covington kids, was in an interview with Alex Jones, and they were discussing how, first of all, Patriot Mike Cernovich had been set up earlier with a doctored video that seemed to show him beating his child. This is the dirty, evil kind of machinations, not by just a big other thing, as the author in Time magazine wrote. It requires real evil people at this point. Not everything is AI yet. These people are going to bring in the AI, but they are real evil human beings. So now the big fabrication about Alex Jones was that he had child porn that was embedded under Sandy Hook. Now, this came to him. He didn't even open it. And first of all, I would like to say that through the years, there has been no radio personality that I know of who has been as inveterate in fighting this worldwide ring of pedophilia than Alex Jones. I recall, Lou, the first time I ever heard his program, and it was June 2nd, 2003, as far as I can remember. And what was he expounding about? It was this very thing, the harm done to children. Through the years, he talked about DynCorp. He talked about the global pedophilia ring when the Penn State business with Sandusky came up. He has always stood firm about this. And now, this is what's important to remember. The FBI reviewed this and exonerated him. Yay! So, you know, whatever you hear, it's like all of these beatings of the futile drums about Mueller's investigation. And now we're going to have a do-over. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. This is very ineffectual at this point. And I think those who would like to destroy Alex Jones, this is going to blow up in their faces because the FBI exonerated him. And these obscene images, you see, were embedded in there. Alex had never seen it, never used it, did not open it. It's important that we realize something that Robert Barnes, that great lawyer, said. He talked about how these mainstream media publications like Wall Street Journal and New York Times, who picked up that story, that their goal is to libel Alex Jones, and that they're trying to inoculate all of those who have never heard about Alex Jones, you see. They're trying to paint him as a villain. And Barnes said, it has the attributes of a script they're promoting. The media is using lawsuits to try to suppress Alex Jones's free speech rights. Now, what could be any different, Blue, than what you read about Winston? There, he had to get rid of the old newspapers and put them down the memory hole. It's not much different, is it?
No, not really. He was being forced to change history. And in a sense, this is the same.
That's right. And when we talked about this possibility of false flags in Iran, we must bring that to people's attention, because we all know how fraudulent the Gulf of Tonkin story was. There have been many false flags. The false flag about the babies being hurt in Kuwait in the incubators, that turned out to be a total lie. Anything to get us into the war machinery, and so those big corporate munitions makers can really profit off the dead young soldiers' bodies. We don't want it. And again, we state that we are really watching President Trump on this. He said in his renewal to run speech that he doesn't want Middle East wars. And we're going to hold him to that. We must do that. Now, I don't know whether there was a little bit more on this. I think there is. This great threat to our First Amendment rights. First of all, we had someone who used his First Amendment rights, and that was candidate Joe Biden. And he said it's almost a time for a physical revolution. He blurted out something like that, Lou, which was really stunning. We heard that under Hillary Clinton there probably would have been a hot war, maybe even some roundups to gulags. We don't know, of Christians. She talked about re-education camps, didn't she?
Yes, she did.
That was her quote, not mine.
Yeah.
Now, this is the next ominous thing on the march to the road that leads to the mark of the beast. Facebook may be trying to create digital currency. And this will eventually marginalize you, you see, according to your political or your religious views. It will devalue your currency. Now, isn't that diabolical?
Absolutely, yes.
And I think this might have been Robert Barnes again who commented on that, that this is one giant open-air re-education camp. And Alex Jones says they're going all the way. I think to normal, good American people, and you know, when people go to our new website, and that's DividedKingdomRadio.com, again, DividedKingdomRadio.com, they'll see our pictures, you and I, current pictures, and it says Mr. and Mrs. America under it. because we feel that we represent a lot of middle-class people and people who are real Americans. Some of our relatives have farms. Some of our relatives work in the banking industry on your side in California. And some of them were in education high up there. They started from a humble background, and they went up higher, didn't they?
Yes, absolutely.
And so we believe that God wants us at this time to be watchmen, not just politically, certainly not. We are calling for repentance in America. We are calling for the borders to be closed. We are calling for God's help, because we will do nothing without God. And we were pleased that President Trump, in his speech, talked about our guide being those words, under God, because our country is nothing without that. You see, things are going more liberal in some nearby countries. For instance, Time magazine, June 17th, had this headline in the news ticker, Canadian indigenous deaths called genocide. After spending nearly 3 years investigating the high number of disappearances and murders among indigenous women in Canada, a national commission called the situation a genocide for which Canada is responsible. This was in a report released June 3rd. Now, indigenous, this does mean Native American, doesn't it?
Yeah, I would think that.
I think so.
Yeah.
Tribal. So you see, who's doing this? What is this? Why is this just in the private sector? People are just filled with violence and hatred for people who are different. Is this something that's part of the population reduction plan? It's so interesting. We have to always look under the surface. But you see, here in America, most people do not approve of the Democrats' ideal, as in New York, when Cuomo celebrated and lit up all the buildings in pink, because we could kill the living result of a late-term abortion if it didn't die. And then Governor Northam wasn't maybe as successful, but he spouted off that the mother and the doctors would decide whether to resuscitate it. We want to shoot that down. We shoot all of that stuff down as Americans who believe in God. We cannot do that. And now, moving back to Lou, I think there are a couple other good things coming with the administration concerning the border situation.
Yes, we have one from June 17th, 2019. Washington Times by Stephen Dinan. Immigrants warned about taking welfare. New policy requires sponsors to pay instead. Officers handling illegal immigration cases will now warn people that they are under an obligation to support themselves rather than end up on the public dole, under a new policy implemented Friday by Ken Cuccinelli, Acting Director of U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. The warning will be issued both to the immigrant and their sponsor, who under the law has signed an agreement not to let the immigrant become a public charge. In the new warning, UCSIS, that is, the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services officers, will remind sponsors that they can and now will be required to pay back every dollar, and that's in quotes, every dollar of welfare that the immigrants take. Mr. Cuccinelli said in a memo to agency employees, quote, "The president has made it a priority to ensure that every individual who seeks to come to the United States is self-sufficient, temporarily or permanently." It's the first public move by Mr. Cuccinelli, who became acting director last week. It's also one of the boldest steps by the agency, which gets less attention than the Border Patrol or deportation officers, but which is nonetheless central to Mr. Trump's immigration plans. The president issued a memo last month urging his agencies to explore ways to make sure immigrants were living up to their terms of admission. That immigrants are supposed to be able to support themselves has long been a part of federal policy, dating back to the very first comprehensive immigration laws enacted in the 1800s. Today, some employment-related immigration cases and most family-based immigration cases, which account for a majority of all immigration, must be accompanied by what's known as Form I-864, which is the Affidavit of Support. As Mr. Cuccinelli explained in a tweet, quote, an affidavit of support is a legal and enforceable contract between the sponsor and the federal government, unquote. Not only is a sponsor supposed to be on the hook for costs, but an immigrant is supposed to be punished for becoming a public charge. But it's been rarely enforced. The Washington Times reported in 2016 that among immigrants from five major national sources of immigration to the United States, just three people were cited for being public charges in the years from 2013 to 2015. Immigration judges sustained just one of those cases. Last week's guidance is an addition to a new regulation USCIS is developing that would expand the cases where migrants would be detained or denied immigration passes or new visas if they become a public burden. Under Clinton-era rules, the government only looks at a narrow set of welfare programs when determining whether an immigrant has become a public charge. The Trump plan, still a work in progress, would add food stamps, public housing, and long-term institutionalized care to that list. That plan would save the government nearly $20 billion, with a B, billion dollars over a decade, the government argued in its draft proposal. Immigrant rights activists have complained that the rules would make it tougher for poor migrants to gain a foothold in the U.S., effectively giving a leg up to more successful immigrants. Activists are already battling a new proposal by the Department of Housing and Urban Development, which would oust households led by immigrants living illegally in the U.S. from government-assisted housing. Thousands of so-called mixed, and that's in quotes, mixed families, where the household head is an immigrant living in the U.S. illegally, but others in the home have legal status or in government-subsidized housing. Activists say it would punish the legal residents in these homes if they lose housing because of their relationship with an immigrant living in the U.S. illegally.
Do you have another article there, or is that it?
Well, I have one about the IRS and Trump's taxes.
Just give us the headline of that.
The headline is, Justice, IRS regularly refused to hand over Trump taxes.
Yes, these witch hunts have to be limited somewhere. We have some very important things that we must get to. And we thank you for listening to The Divided Kingdom. And if you would like to help us stay on air, you don't have any commercials that interfere with you, and you're listening, and we do not have any corporate sponsors of any type. We just have a little bit of your help whenever you send us a little help. So our address is Lou Caverly, Post Office Box 28, was brought out very recently by Paul Joseph Watson on InfoWars. There was a lesbian couple in Brazil, and they themselves performed the sex surgery on their little 8-year-old boy. He did survive for about a year. And then the completely insane mother, I don't know whether she was his real mother, because there was a father trying to get custody, but they gouged out his eyes because she said it reminded her of her father who abused her. And finally, he was decapitated, and they tried to do some barbecue burning, and that didn't work out. God Almighty, where are we? If the churches don't soon stand up, where are we? And now, Lou has a big expose tonight. The bombshell article, our key article, is the Boy Scouts. What were they really like, even going way back? Lou?
This is from Time Magazine. Those of us alive back in the 1950s, we recall fondly the Boy Scouts of America, Scout Oath. It was quoted ubiquitously throughout all American culture and life. We believed in it. We believed it was a symbol of an organization's integrity.
And what is that oath?
And the oath says, on my honor, I will do my best to do my duty to God and my country, and to obey the Scout law, to help other people at all times, to keep myself physically strong, mentally awake, and morally straight. Now we find out the serpent was always in it, hollowing out the integrity, blowing the venomous poison of destruction into young people's lives.
And we do have to applaud Time Magazine for this very, very thorough expose. We recall back when Newsweek, the printed edition, was still extant. We had an important program on the results of it was a drug that women took that deformed thalidomide, I believe it was, deformed their children. They didn't have normal limbs. And the Nazi connections to that. Do you recall we had that program, Blue?
Oh, yes. Yes, very
much. And so now, in the tradition of that good journalism, truthful journalism, this we do applaud Time for this particular article.
And the article is dated June 17th, 2019, and it gets our applause for this courageous expose. It's entitled, The Window for Justice May Be Closing, by Eliana Docterman. These former Boy Scouts say the organization's sex abuse problem is worse than anyone knew. 48 years ago, Edward Pitson says the scoutmaster who had taught him to use a compass and light a campfire said he was going to teach Pitson about sex. The scoutmaster invited Pitson, who was 12, to his house and asked him to lie in the bed. Man assured the boy he had seen other Boy Scouts naked. Quote, this is the normal way to learn about sex, Pitson recalls the scoutmaster telling him. He said, but don't tell your parents what I'm doing. They wouldn't think you're mature enough. They wouldn't understand, unquote. The man told Pitson a quote-unquote dirty story, pulled down his pants, and masturbated him. Pitson can't remember if this happened once or if the scoutmaster invited him over again a few weeks later. But he does remember pulling up his pants after a few minutes and walking out of the room. Pitson recalls, quote, he called after me, calling me a baby and trying to make me feel guilty. I just wanted to go home, unquote. About 4 years later, Pitson, furious that the man remained a scoutmaster, told his parents what had happened. He says they spoke to the bishop of their family's local church in Northern California, the same church that sponsored the Boy Scout troop, and the scoutmaster was quietly removed from his position. Pitson says he also spoke to the bishop, but as far as he knows, nobody reported the scoutmaster to the police. Now Pitson is one of hundreds of men and boys hoping for a last chance at restitution in case the Boy Scouts, hit by a costly litigation arising from abuse allegations, file for bankruptcy. Attorneys say they've collected information recently from more than 500 men and boys whose accounts of rape, molestation, and abuse indicate the Boy Scouts' pedophile problem is far more widespread than the organization has previously acknowledged. These men are speaking out for the first time, and several of them detail their allegations of abuse in interviews with Time. Time was not able to confirm the men's specific accounts, but spoke with others who said they'd been told of the incidents. Time also obtained a police report filed by one of the individuals alleging abuse. The men hope to illuminate a problem that has plagued but never fully exposed the Boy Scouts, an institution that for 109 years has vowed to teach youngsters good manners, useful skills, and a sense of right and wrong. For generations of men, the Boy Scouts have been central to their identity as good citizens. Presidents from John F. Kennedy to George W. Bush have touted their scouting credentials as proof of a virtuous grounding. Lawyers for the ex-scouts, though, paint a picture of an organization that has failed not only those who were abused, but the entire country. The Boy Scouts of America is a federally chartered nonprofit that must provide annual reports to Congress. And attorneys for the former scouts say the organization did not include information about abuse accusations in those records. Quote, they were reporting that they were a wholesome organization, says Tim Kostnoff, one of the attorneys. He went on to say, they were kicking out child molesters at the rate of one every 2 days for 100 years. Unquote.
Would you just repeat that line, please?
Yep. They were reporting they were a wholesome organization when they were kicking out child molesters at the rate of one every 2 days for 100 years. In a statement of time, the Boy Scouts denied withholding any relevant information from Congress or enabling abusers. Quote, for decades, the BSA has provided Congress with a yearly report that meets the requirements of our charter. Unquote. But separately, the Boy Scouts chief executive, Michael B. Serbaugh, has acknowledged that the organization, quote, did in at least some instances allow individuals to return to scouting even after credible accusations of sexual abuse. And Serbaugh also added, I am devastated that this ever occurred. And he added that in a May 28th letter to lawmakers looking into the Boy Scouts' handling of abuse claims. Former Scouts have brought hundreds of individual sex abuse cases against the Boy Scouts over the past several decades. And in 2010, a judge ordered the organization to make public an internal list of men accused of preying on boys. Within Scouts headquarters, the list was known as the P-Files, or perversion files. In January, a sex crimes expert hired by the Boy Scouts to analyze these files testified that she found 12,254 boys had reported experiencing sexual abuse at the hands of at least 7,800 suspected assailants between 1944 and 2016. Academics who research child abuse tell Time that that number is a gross underestimate. Many boys were likely intimidated or shamed out of reporting their assailants, who often held influential positions in local churches, schools, or businesses. The cascading claims of misconduct invite comparison to the Catholic Church's sex abuse scandal. In both cases, institutions entrusted with the care of boys responded by protecting themselves instead of the victims of the abuse. The Catholic Church faced more than 10,000 accusations of child abuse in the U.S. between 1950 and 2002, according to one report. In fact, many of the former Scouts who have waited decades to come forward say they were inspired by other victims who spoke out about long-ago abuse, both in the church and in the entertainment, media, and sports industries, and saw that perpetrators toppled from power positions and in some cases prosecuted. Those testimonies have also spurred several states to extend the statute of limitations on sex abuse cases, opening the doors to more legal claims. The Boy Scouts quietly hired lobbyists to push against such laws for fear of facing an onslaught of criminal cases. Kosnoff, who has brought more than 100 cases against the Boy Scouts since 2007, calls the Boy Scouts' behavior a century-long cover-up. Indeed, so many individuals have sued the organization, alleging harassment, molestation, and rape, that insurers have refused to pay out settlements, arguing in court filings last year that the Boy Scouts could have reasonably prevented the abuse. Kosnoff had retired to Puerto Rico when he learned that the Boy Scouts were considering bankruptcy, a tactic some Catholic dioceses have used to stall lawsuits against them. Outraged, the lawyer recruited attorneys from two other law firms to launch a national ad campaign in March to draw clients. Their goal is to lay the groundwork for possible legal action even if the Boy Scouts file for bankruptcy, and a judge sets a deadline for new claims to be filed. Says Kosnoff, quote, we're struggling to keep up with the response. The legal team says the men who have come forward so far have named more than 300 hidden creditors, that's in quotes, hidden creditors who did not appear in the perversion files. Time is not publishing their names because a suit identifying them has not been filed. However, Kosnoff would like to push the Boy Scouts to list the names of the men his clients have accused in a public database. Based on his experience representing church abuse victims, Kosnoff worries that bankruptcy proceedings could bury the names of potential assailants. He says, quote, the assailants who would otherwise be identified in lawsuits get enshrouded in darkness, and these predators can continue to operate, unquote. That's Pitson's fear as well. He has tracked down the man he says abused him on Google. Says Pitson, now a 70-year-old retired transit supervisor, in Vallejo, California, with five sons. Quote, he's still alive. I would love this guy to answer for what he's done. It's not too late, unquote. The man Pitson named, who's now 86, denies ever being a scoutmaster in California or knowing anything about Pitson's allegation. I don't remember any of that. You must have the wrong person, he told Time.
Went down the memory hole.
Yes, that's right. At its 1972 peak, membership in the Boy Scouts numbered more than 6 million. Families across the country were eager to enroll their sons in the organization that touted mentorship from older men and bonding activities with other boys, including camping trips. It was on one such trip in 1961 that Pitson says he first became aware of his scout master's strange behavior. Pitson and the rest of his troop were sitting around a campfire in the woods with a man who, like all scout masters, was an unpaid volunteer. He suggested a group of 12 and 13-year-old boys stand up and start pulling down each other's pants, and the scoutmaster's pants as well. He called them pantsing parties, and Pitson says he frequently proposed them during scout outings. Another time, the scoutmaster was driving Pitson and a few other boys to a meeting. Pitson recalls that one of the boys had started dating a girl, and his friends were teasing him about the romance. He remembers the scoutmaster saying, quote, I'll pay you $5 if you have sex with her, unquote. Pitson has never been shy about sharing his story. He has told family members and girlfriends, and he blames the abuse for broken relationships. Quote, he planted the seed in my head. Boys talk about sex at that age, but not as much as he encouraged us to do, he says. And then, with what happened, I felt like I became obsessed with sex and its meaning in my life, unquote. In light of the scoutmaster's mention of encounters with other boys, he wonders if his fellow scouts were abused, too. Many of the men who contacted Kosnoff believed that they were just one of many scouts abused by one perpetrator. Kendall Kimber, now 60, had risen through the Boy Scout ranks quickly. Growing up in Northern California, he learned navigation on hunting trips with his father and developed a strong work ethic while peeling potatoes at his mother's restaurant. By 12 or 13, Kimber had been tapped for an elite scouting group, the Order of the Arrow, so he didn't find it strange when a scoutmaster offered to help him with a project he needed to complete to earn the honor. But Kimber says that when he arrived at the man's house, the scoutmaster handed Kim a Playgirl magazine and asked the boy to perform oral sex in him. Kimber, terrified, did so. Quote, I was very small in stature for my age and was kind of intimidated anyway because of that, he says. I felt cheated because the only thing I was good at was being a scout. But after that happened, I just walked away from scouting. I was done, unquote. Kimber did not know it then, but the same man allegedly abused two of Kimber's close relatives in the same troop. The men revealed their trauma to one another after one of them saw the lawyer's ad urging victims to come forward. Kimber suspects that the same scoutmaster also abused his younger brother. But he'll never know. Kimber says his brother died of complications from drug abuse years ago. The relatives kept the abuse to themselves when they were kids, but the secret grew like a tumor inside the family. Each boy began to show signs of trauma. Two turned to drugs. One drank heavily. Quote, me? I don't really know how to describe me. I don't smoke and I don't do drugs. But I guess I'm extremely jaded toward people, he says, pausing. It makes me sick to my stomach. He went after everybody in my family. I guarantee you he has gone after many others, unquote. Time was unable to obtain updated contact information for the man Kimber says abused him. James Kretschmer, 56, says a scout leader targeted him during a treasure hunt during a retreat in Washington State. The man gave the group of 11 and 12-year-old boys different coordinates that would lead them all to the same point and promise that the boy who reached the final location first would be rewarded with a bag of candy. Kretschmer won. Quote, of course, when I look back, I think, wow, the coordinates all led back to the scout leader's tent, Kretschmer says. The scoutmaster congratulated Kretschmer, and things seemed normal until the boys crawled into their sleeping bags later that night. Kretschmer left his open. Quote, They're made of down, and if it's not colder than heck, you don't zip them up because you'll sweat to death in them, Kreshma says. And then I felt breath on my neck and felt somebody fondling me. I just froze and pretended like nothing was happening. I thought maybe it would go away. This is the one memory that sticks out with him. He's blocked out most of the rest and can't recall the name of his abuser. He calculates, though, that the abuse lasted for 4 to 6 months. As an adult, Kreshma has struggled with alcohol problems and spent years in and out of counseling on antidepressants. He says, quote, I've been married and divorced 4 times, and I will stand up and say right now it's probably because of the simple fact that I built a shell to protect myself because of the trauma, unquote. Studies show that survivors of child sex abuse are at increased risk of psychological and physical ailments, including PTSD, depression, drug abuse, diabetes, heart attack, and stroke. The lawyers say many, and that's in quotes, many of their clients have turned to alcohol, drugs, or even crime to cope with that past. Says Kosnoff, quote, imagine being sodomized as a 7-year-old and trying to process that. It's a ticking time bomb in your soul. It just erodes a person from the inside out. Experts say boys struggle with such a violation of trust differently than girls do. Ellie Neuberger, a pediatrician who studies child abuse at Boston's Children's Hospital and has testified in cases involving pedophilia and the Boy Scouts, says men tend to disclose instances of assault at a much later age than women. He says there is a stigma of coming forward for both men and women. But unfortunately for men, there is the shame, the extra shame that you are not able to protect yourself, that you are found to be powerless, unquote. He adds that in certain parts of the country, men who were abused by men additionally fear coming forward and facing homophobia, even if, or especially if, they do not identify as queer. A 60-year-old Massachusetts man who says he and other boys in his troop were raped over a dozen times in the woods by a scoutmaster as teenagers still cringes when someone he does not know comes too close. Says the man, who didn't want to be identified, quote, even to this day, I don't like strangers touching me at all, even on the shoulder. I just jerk away. A 17-year-old from Michigan is still struggling to process the abuse. He says a scoutmaster targeted him around the age of 7, just as his parents had separated, and he was the most vulnerable. He did stop below the torso area, if you get my drift, he says. The Michigan boy revealed the details of his abuse years later to his grandmother, quote, because she is the wisest woman I know, unquote. Since the abuse had transpired long ago, it didn't seem like there was much they could do. He said, quote, I just sort of dropped it, and she sort of dropped it until a few months ago when I was on my computer and she was watching TV, he says. His grandmother spotted the lawyer's advertisement and tapped her grandson on the shoulder. She suggested the teen might find closure, but he also wants the decade of abuse against children to stop. He says, I have been hearing good things about this whole Me Too movement. I figured, yeah, if I could help this not happen to other kids, then why not? The Boy Scouts say that they've made changes in recent years to identify and eliminate abusers from the organization, including creating the 24-hour Scouts First helpline to report misconduct. The phone line, quote, is one of many resources we provide volunteers, staff, parents, and others to support reporting of any account of suspected abuse or behavior that might put a youth in our programs at risk, the Scouts said in their statement to Time. But a Maryland mother who says her then 14-year-old son was sexually abused by 2 older teenage counselors at a Boy Scout camp last year didn't find it helpful. When she called, she says the person who had answered was not an expert trained in handling abuse allegations, but a volunteer working from home. She could hear their dogs barking in the background. She also says the person who answered told her she would have to visit the police station with her son and file a report if she wanted to alert authorities. The distressed mother says she called the helpline after first contacting the camp director. She told the director that the 2 counselors had shoved their penises into her son's shorts pockets while taunting him in a changing room. "Boys will be boys," she recalls the camp counselor telling her. After several more calls to various members of the Boy Scout organization, she and her son went to their local police and filed a report. The accused camp counselors, who were both minors, denied the allegations to police and to the camp's director, and no charges were filed. Every Boy Scout knows the scouting oath by heart. Be trustworthy, loyal, helpful, friendly, courteous, kind, obedient, cheerful, thrifty, brave, clean, and reverent. Quote, "My son recited those words every single week," says a teenager's mother. "What we as a family just cannot get over is the fact that those values were completely violated," unquote. In that statement, the Boy Scouts say their policies to encourage helpline callers to contact law enforcement themselves, quote, "because the person reporting the abuse typically has the most information about the matter, and the authorities, therefore, will want to receive the report directly from them," unquote. Today, the Boy Scouts count about 2.4 million young members and a million adult volunteers in their ranks. In the face of public pressure to be more inclusive and to bolster membership, the Boy Scouts dropped the ban on adult leaders who are open or avowed homosexuals and began admitting girls and transgender kids in 2017. Conservative organizations have protested the changes, while liberal groups have argued they've moved too slowly. But nothing has affected the Boy Scouts' public image like a landmark sex abuse lawsuit in 2010. That year, an Oregon jury ordered the organization to pay $18.5 million in damages to a sex abuse victim.
And so we see that if you want the rest of that article, you can go into Time Magazine, but it's enough to show us that the evil forces would like to continue the cover-up, delay the steps, make them go to the police, and then it'll be easier to keep covering it up. But we can't think that God will allow that forever. He won't. The light is being shined on the evil, and the light is being shined on those drag queen story hours at your local library. Where are you going to draw the line? Thank you for listening to The Divided Kingdom. Good night.